listening to Beside Stillwater's Netcast, a tabernacle service of Stillwater's home churches and worship center.
There's a scripture. I mean, this is a terrible wording. It's from the Psalms. But this is a terrible wording of it as far as translations go. But as far as what it means, it is so spot on. And I remember it in the way that the Living Bible, which is not a translation, it's a paraphrase. But I remember it better from that translation. What it says is, be careful how you think, because your thoughts will shape your life. At a very difficult time in my life, when I was being done wrong, I was innocent, and I was being done wrong, and I didn't understand where God could possibly be. A lot like Psalm 107. With addictions, I mean, I can tell you a few things about addictions, and I could put something down and not touch it for hours and not think about it because it was in the room. It was available. But when I tried to quit, that same amount of time that I had an easy time with when it was in the room because I knew I wasn't quitting, the moment that I determined that I was going to quit, that's all I could think about. Whether it's cigarettes or drugs or alcohol, whatever it is, what we do is when it doesn't become a challenge until we determine something, and then in our minds we'll fixate on something, and that would make me not quit. So at this time in my life, when things were so horrific and things were bad, and I didn't understand why this was happening to me, and I've done everything right, and everything is going wrong, and I'm put upon, and this is the worst situation. I was counseled how to deal with that. And what I wanted the counselor to say to me is I wanted him to say, "You're right. You're justified. You're good to go. It's the other person. It's the other people. They're wrong. I'd be mad too if I were you. I would, you know, you're justified." And he wouldn't give me that advice, though. And I sat there and I was all indignant. "What are you talking about?" And he told me, he said, "Be careful how you think, because your thoughts will shape your life." And he based his whole counseling. It's called, in psychology, they call it cognitive therapy, because it's the way you think. If you change the way you think, you will change everything around you. Don't get me wrong. There's some horrible teaching out there that bumps right up against the truth. Did you ever watch Wayne Dyer on PBS? Dr. Wayne Dyer. He wrote Pulling Your Own Strings and Your Erroneous Zones years and years ago, and now he's got this new thing on. I forget the name of the book. I read it. And it's actually a really good book. It's a really good book. And his PBS specials are really good, but what they have to do with is that you are connected to God. He calls God Source. And he talks about connecting with Source. And he talks about, you know, that you've been made to be in cooperation with Source. Now, what I would say as a Christian is I know who Source is. And the stuff that he says with regard to that is true. And what he's saying is stop thinking the way you think and start connecting to God and think the way he does, and then things around you seem to change. And even the things that don't change, I'm not talking about situations, I'm talking about your countenance. I'm talking about who you are inside. I'm talking about the light in your own eyes. I'm talking about peace, even when things are going bad. And so this counselor, he's giving me this rather Wayne Dyer-ish kind of counsel, telling me that I need to be responsible for me and how I think. What I wanted is I wanted him to tell me and point out all the good things, that I was doing this right, and because I was doing it right, nothing bad should happen. How many people really experience that, though? Bad things happen when people are doing the right things. Bad things happen. Things go wrong. And what the film was talking about is he's talking about our imagination. What is an imagination? What is your imagination? It's your thoughts. It's you dwelling on things. It's what makes up your thoughts. And my scriptures tell me, you know, not, they don't tell me don't imagine. They tell me cast off, cast away, get rid of vain imaginations. Well, what's a vain imagination? It's something that is not going to prosper you. And I don't mean money. I mean that will not foster peace. Your imagination, your thoughts. Most of the time, when I'm struggling, it didn't happen out of a circumstance. That might have began with a circumstance, but my struggle really becomes what I'm thinking about. Did you ever wake up in the middle of the night with a thought? Almost randomly, a worry, and now you're up. And you're up all night because you can't turn that off. You can't stop thinking about it. I do that a lot, I'm confessing to you. Is that perfection? Absolutely not. Am I head over heels in sin when I'm doing that? Absolutely. You know, just because what, you know, Jesus told us not to take what for tomorrow? Thought. Imagination. He told us not to worry. Those worrying thoughts. Here we have Joshua chapter 3. About Joshua taking over for Moses. Now, we've gone through, you know, the promise to Abraham, and we've gone through all these experiences coming up to this moment. We've been through Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. We've been through their screwed up relationships. We've been through, you know, the Exodus and how they were a people who were invited to Egypt, and Pharaoh turned on them, and then they went into the desert. And recently we've been talking about how God was struggling with them to get Egypt out of them because their imaginations were back there. Their thoughts were back there. The generation that came out in the Exodus over into this new world, so to speak, was a desert. It was struggle. It wasn't ideal situations. They came from a society that was, they had goods and services, and they had, you know, roads, and they had things, and even though, you know, this Pharaoh was bad, they had a pretty good life prior to that. And they come out, and God leads them out into this place, because what they did is they absorbed too much Egypt, and now here they are on the other side of the Red Sea in the Exodus. And God says that they can't enter the land, the new world, because they don't reflect him. They reflect Egypt. The golden calf that we talked about, they did an Egyptian thing. They created God in an Egyptian likeness. There was a whole lot of stuff like that. And so God takes them on this journey through the desert, and they're afraid. Because they're taking thought for tomorrow. What will happen to us? What's going to happen? And they don't know. And so he does these wonderful things. You know, remember that he sent the manna and he sent the quail. And he did these things to take care of them. And then he brought forth water out of a rock. And he gave them something to drink and quenched their thirst. And they did all these things. And Moses was their mouthpiece. I mean, was the mouthpiece for God. Moses heard God for them because they were afraid of him. But Moses knew God face to face, as we talked about last week. That means that Moses was really, really honest with him and told him exactly how he felt, didn't hide anything from him. If Moses was having a bad day, God knew about it. Not because he knows everything and he's omniscient. It's because Moses was straight up with him. Moses wasn't withholding stuff. And so he has this really wonderful relationship. And last week we talked about how Moses embraced Joshua and brought him into that little circle, so to speak, and gave him credibility. And here in this story, in Joshua chapter 3, God's saying, Joshua, I'm going to have the same relationship with you that I had with Moses. I want to be just as tight with you as I was with Moses. And so when you hear me say things to you, honor that and do these things in the sight of all the people and tell them how I feel about things. Tell them what I think. And in this story, this sounds fantastic. And it is. Because what this story is that Missy read, what do? They're getting ready to leave this desert, this new generation. The ones who have never been in Egypt. They were born and grew up in the desert because God needed sort of a clean slate, you know, and what did he do? He gave them laws. And the world will call them the you better nots or the thou shalt nots. And we've, and in discussing that, we've arrived that God meant it for really, really good stuff. And we called it the you won'ts. You won't work on the Sabbath. I'm not going to let you. I'm giving you the day off. Not like Egypt. I'm giving you the day off. You won't work on the Sabbath. You know what? You won't have another God before me. You won't want to. And you see, that's what the Ten Commandments are. This new generation grew up knowing these things and grew up with all these good laws that God was giving to Moses and he was giving to the people and Aaron was helping to administer that and then he brought people along to help him because Moses was wearing out. And so we come to this part of the story when Moses is done and the new generation is ready and they're ready to go into they're ready to leave because Egypt isn't in them anymore. God does something with Joshua. He does notice that they are not a nation. They pick representatives from the tribes, the 12 sons, the family. And what does he do? He has what he sends out before them, something that they use their imagination to encounter. It's the Ark of the Covenant. And although the lectionary isn't discussing it this in this text, the Ark of the Covenant has some things in it. And the things that it has in it, it has a jar of the manna that he wouldn't let them starve in the desert. He took care of them. They were worried. Their imagination said, oh, what's going to happen to us? Let's go back to Egypt. And God says, no, you don't take thought for tomorrow. No, don't worry. And he gives them this food from heaven, and he feeds them with it. And a jar, they're not even allowed to store this, but one jar gets stored in the ark. And the ark is just this little tiny kind of box. And it's meant to be holy. It's meant to be, let's not treat this like a piece of furniture. let's really treat this. I mean, it's he said how he wanted it built, and it's and there's two cherub with their wings spread out over it, and these cherub, these angels are looking down into what the holiness of God is. It's called the mercy seat of God. And it's and you hear about that from Ezekiel, and the prophets would talk about how cherubs would fly overhead. Remember you know, in Isaiah, and remember in Daniel, and they would fly overhead, and they would look down into his holiness, into his mercy. And that's what this box represents. It represents God's mercy, and it represents the heart of God, and even the angels that fly overhead, possibly singing holy, 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 are there, and they're covering it, and they're looking down into God's holiness. And what's in God's holiness? The way he takes care of us. The manna, he wouldn't let them starve. They were afraid, and he wouldn't let them starve. They're in a new world, you know, he's trying to get Egypt out of them, and he's saying, trust me, trust me. Trust me. Trust me today. And then when they get to tomorrow, trust me today. And then they get to tomorrow, and he says, trust me today. And everything that comes along, whether it's snakes in the desert or whatever, he has a solution for them. And he loves them, and he makes sure that they're okay. And they're not taken away by their fear eventually. What else is in that ark is Aaron's staff that budded. A dead piece of wood that came to life. And you got to understand, the staff that came to life was from the priest. The spokesman, so to speak, for God. I'm always going to talk to you. You're always going to hear from me. I'm not going to leave you. I'm not going to forsake you. And so that's represented there in the ark. And then there are the Ten Commandments that are inside the ark. And so what's in God's mercy, what's in his mercy, inside this ark that these angels are looking down into, they're looking into his holiness. It's not just an ordinary piece of furniture. It is something holy. It says who he is. And inside his mercy is his law. And his law is a good law. Not to beat you up. It's the eye. You won't want to's. You're not going to. It's good laws. It's the assurance that they will always hear from him. It is the manna that they're always going to be fed by him. And what happens here is Joshua takes them on. Did any of this sound familiar? Joshua takes them through the water. And the water dries up. Does this sound anything like the Exodus to you? Because this is a new Exodus. They are leaving the old like a baptism. The baptism. And what they did is they left Egypt and they came through the water to the other side. A new world where God was working on them and God was changing them and making them more like him and getting them to understand. Does that sound like a baptism to you? The old you is over here on the banks of Egypt, and you go through the water and come out the other side into his world. And he's with them, and he lives with them, and he teaches them, and he guides them through the pillar of cloud and the pillar of smoke, and he teaches them how to worship him. And they learn how to worship. And then, when they're ready, they are leaving the desert, the difficulty, and they're going through the water on dry ground, just like they did the Red Sea. They go through the Jordan, and all the water heaps up on one side, and it dries. They cross through on dry ground, and they go out on the other side, just like a baptism. They leave the desert through the water into God's promise. Except this time, what they have in front of them is they have all the promises that he gave them in the desert. Everything goes first. Everything. The ark goes first. They understand what all that means. And that's what gets to go first. And it goes into the new world. And what it talks about, it doesn't talk about going and killing people. What it talks about is it says that I'm going to drive these people out from before you. But the truth is that these people are not to be militarily vanquished. God's going to use this new people. Remember last week we talked about the area that he's giving them from horizon to horizon. That was the land that he was giving them. Driving these people out is driving out what they're attached to. Because a lot of these people become Jews, transplants, because that's what their mission is. Show them who God is. Teach them who God is. And God's people have increased. Maybe they're not even Jews, but they understand who God is. They understand from their past how God has provided for them. And they get to tell people about that. And what's not here in the text for this week, if you read on in chapter 3, and I'm encouraging you to do that, they do some things. What they do is they, one person from each of the tribes takes a stone from the dry riverbed that they just crossed over and bring it out onto the shore of where they've crossed over to. And they pile them up. And they make something, and what they make is a remembrance. Because their kids are going to walk there. Remember the Shema? You teach your kids as you're walking by the wayside, and you're laying down, and you're rising up from last week. Remember that? From Deuteronomy chapter 6? And what's going on here is they're going to be walking by this place with their kids. They're going to be walking by with foreigners. They're going to be walking by years from now when nobody, you know, when this story, they'll have to read it because it won't be in their recent memory. It'll be told to them. And what they're supposed to do is they're supposed to point to those rocks and say, ah, right there, because it'll start the conversation. What is that? What is that remembrance there? And then you tell them the story. So what we have is we have the Ark of the Covenant is God sparking their imagination, bringing things to remembrance, not vain imaginations, good imaginations, good thoughts, remembering where we've been, remembering how bad it was, and remembering how God didn't let us down. And then we come through on the other side, and these kids and the next generations to come are going to say, Dad, what's up with those rocks over there, those pillars? What is that? Oh, let me tell you a story. And you're starting the cycle of beginning your kids' imagination. And that's what this is. This is family telling the story down through the generations. Down through the generations. And giving them the stories that they can trust God. And that he's a good God. And that even when times were tough, he was with them. And we have the ark to prove it. We have the stuff in the ark. And there, God met with us. Joshua was part of bringing them into a new land and making memories for them where they draw faith. Now, here's the interesting thing. Imagination and memories and thoughts are all the things that worship is made up of. As we prayed here when we were worshiping, and I was thanking God for slowing us down, I don't remember the words I used, but slowing us down, bringing us to a place of contemplativeness where we are intentionally stopping the clutter in our minds and we're concentrating on Him, because see, then our imagination, our thoughts are on Him. And if I slow down enough and I remember the things that He's brought me through, even the counselor that said, yeah, you've been done wrong, but change the way you think because your thoughts are going to shape your life. I could have turned into a bitter, horrible person. I could have let that shape my life just because of my own imagination. The things that I would choose to dwell on rather than dwelling on the things of God. So worship has everything. Worship is dwelling on God. Faith is dwelling on God. It's denying the stuff of the past and seeing things from His perspective instead. And when we get in lockstep with Him, as far as that's concerned, then we're having fellowship with Him. We're like Moses and we're seeing Him face to face. And we're not putting on a mask and pretending. We're not hypocrites. We're honest in front of God. If I'm struggling with something, I'm going to be honest in front of God. I'm not going to try snowing Him. But that's what we do. And the beginning of that is memories. At Christmas, we do things to intentionally remember things. You know, during Lent, we do things intentionally to remember things. Because, you know what, if Lent doesn't roll around, I'm not going to do it. So Joshua is here, creating memories for Israel to have faith and worship throughout the rest of their journey. And God's faithful in those things. In those provisions of God, as a people, things go horribly wrong. And like I said, it starts up here. Then Jesus said to the crowds and to His disciples, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit on Moses' seat." It's the lawgiver, telling them what to do, figuring things out for them, keep them safe. That's the seat that these guys are supposed to be sitting in. "Therefore, do what they teach you and follow it, because the law is in the book. I can read that law and I can be safe. But do not do as they do, for they do not practice what they teach." What does that mean? Does that mean that they, you know, somebody comes with, remember we talked about the law, somebody comes with a skin disorder and shows themselves to the priest and he tells them how to cure it? Or he says, you might have to separate yourself from the community, like we talked about last week? You know, just to make sure you're both safe, you know, and then we'll figure out what this is. Is that what they're doing? See, that law, last week we talked about the black and whiteness to the law, how it's already there on the page, it's the black words on the white parchment, and there is what it is. But the humanity that's behind it, we talked about. Well, here, they are prescribing the law. They're saying what the law is. They're saying the words, but they've poured a different meaning into them. Now, that black and white law, that good law that's there, has lost the humanity that's attached to it. Now it's just words on a page. Now it's just do's and don'ts. Now it's just you do this and you do that, because what they did is they added to it. They re-engineered this and they turned it into a purity code. They turned it into a litmus test for how good of a Jew you are, how good of a follower of God you are, how good you are at being able to be religious. And if you have that skin disease, you must have sinned. So these guys are sitting in the seat of Moses. They're supposed to be being like Moses. They're supposed to be being like Joshua. They're supposed to be giving them hope. They're supposed to be giving them the law. They're supposed to have the ark and understand that that's really the mercy of God and all that goodness and how God's so very present with them. And fear not. But it's turned into wickedness. It's turned into difficulty. The law gets ugly here. Listen to this. So it goes, he describes, "They do not practice what they teach. They tie up heavy burdens,
hard to bear, and they lay them on the shoulders of others. But they themselves aren't even willing to lift a finger to move them. They do all of their deeds to be seen by others. For they make their phylacteries broad and their fringes long. That's a way that you pray. You tie the scriptures to your head or to your forearm, and then people know that you're praying. And you make the tassels long, and you make them wide so nobody misses it. And you see, they're pumping themselves up. They've somehow become people that are up here, and everybody else is down here. And they're doing it so that they get noticed by people. They love to have the place of honor at banquets and the best seat in the synagogues and to be greeted with respect in the marketplace and have people call them rabbi. But you are not to be called rabbi, for you have one teacher and you are all students. And call no one your father on earth, for you have one father, the one in heaven. Nor are you to be called instructors, for you have one instructor, the Messiah. The greatest among you will be your servant. All who exalt themselves will be humbled, and all who humble themselves will be exalted. See what happens in this part of their history, before they're coming into the land. Joshua is bringing them in, a baptism into goodness, led by God's mercy and by what he is, with the ark going before them. And they build a remembrance, and they stack up the stones, and when they walk by with their kids, they can tell them the story of God helping them and loving them and being merciful to them and caring for them. And by this part of the story, Jesus is saying, don't be like them. This is where they've come to. And those things that were in the ark, the law, is just ugly now. Now it's a bunch of you better nots, and it's just ugly. The manna, the food that he gave them from heaven, the things they had to trust him for. They got good in themselves. They got good at keeping the law. They got good at providing for themselves. They got good at taking care of themselves, and they really didn't need him. They're comfortable. They don't have to rely on God anymore. They have their law, and they're good at it. His voice becomes corrupt. Remember? Aaron, the prophet, his staff. I'll always be with you. You'll always get to hear my voice. Well, they sit in Moses' seat. They're his voice. They've corrupted his voice. This is called a misuse of power. That's what this is. And it's a dreadful thing to watch, because I don't think Jesus was some placid sort of guy that you see in the movies, you know, where he's got this faraway look in his eyes and he's all distant and all ethereal and his feet are barely touching the ground and everything's soft and gentle. Because I see Jesus as, I just emailed somebody today, that I see Jesus as a wild man, a very passionate guy, who when he sees injustice, he can't stand it. He sees his father's house being turned into a den of thieves, and he freaks. He can't contain himself because the injustice is so bad, and his father's house was meant to be what the ark represents. It was supposed to be what these tribes were supposed to be. It's what this family was supposed to be. And they're not now. And their worship isn't even worthy of God, because their imagination, what is their imagination? It's vain. What are they thinking about? They're thinking about themselves. They're thinking about how to do it and how not to do it. They're thinking about, if you're not with us, then you're nothing. They're mistreating people with God's law. They're misrepresenting God. So his temple is corrupt, and Jesus freaks out and he starts overturning tables. They're actually robbing people. If you couldn't bring herds, you know, you sold them and you brought them to the temple, and then when you were at the temple, you would give them the money, and then they would give you herds to sacrifice in the temple. And they had dishonest scales. They were ripping people off. It turned into business. Business. The temple turned into business. Was it last week or the week before we talked about what image did they pull out of their pocket? Caesar's, a graven image, out of their pocket. They didn't have temple money in their hand. They had Roman money. So Jesus calls them hypocrites. And what the word hypocrite means is somebody who's an actor. Somebody wears a mask. Somebody who, on the outside, is pretending to be all godlike. They're phylacteries. All, you know, they have them very, very visible. Their tassels on their, you know, letting them know that, letting everybody know, hey, I'm a Pharisee. Respect me. Give me the seat of honor. That's what this has become. And that began in their imagination. It began with their thoughts. And now we're to this place that the temple system is corrupt. Israel is corrupt. People are being abused. Does this sound familiar to you? Could it be that the church has come to this place? Could it be that the church is more worried about either one, not making waves, or being just like the world, looking just like them? If we are disciples of Christ, we are just like him. We walk around doing the same things. So the things that he got passionate about are the things that we ought to be getting passionate about. The things that would make him weep are the things that ought to make us cry. The things that pissed him off ought to piss us off. When we see corruption and injustice, how we can sit back and cooperate with that? And most of our churches look like businesses. You have a board to decide this and a board to decide that. You have the money going around. You have business meetings. You have a hierarchy where he's saying that you're all students. So where the heck did the hierarchy come from? Jesus is saying we're all students. We're not supposed to put ourselves up here. And he also goes on to say that the ones who will humble themselves are the ones who will be exalted. The greatest among you will be what? The servant. The servant of all. Not the chief mahath. Not the guy on the top of the ladder. The guy at the bottom. That's what they were supposed to have learned in the desert. How to trust God and become that kind of people. And then go into this new world and be that kind of people. And their imaginations corrupted them. And they turned into the wrong kind of people. You see, Jesus talked about, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So what they have in their heart and what we have in our heart gives us away. What is important to us? And what those words are, the work will follow it. So our thoughts will shape our lives. It's interesting that the word service in the Bible, in the New Testament, is the same word for worship. See, when we're standing before God and worshiping, we're serving him. We're giving him, you know what? God doesn't need anything except us to love him. He wants that. And if that's the thing that he needs and we give it to him, we're working. We're serving. We're worshiping. Worth-ship. So when we talk about Jesus being the Word and when it talks about his Word in us, what that does is that prompts us to not only worship him here, get tight with him here, but the worship continues out there because there's a shelter to run. There are people to pick up off the street. There are people who are getting their bank accounts robbed, and we know who they are. There are people who are dying because they don't want anything except to give in to their darker selves. You remember our labor and toil, brothers and sisters. We work night and day so that we might not burden any of you while we proclaim to you the gospel of God. You are witnesses, and God also, how pure, upright, and blameless our conduct was toward you believers. This is Paul talking to the Thessalonians. As you know, we dealt with each one of you like a father with his children, urging and encouraging you and pleading that you lead a life worthy of God, who calls you into his own kingdom and glory. We also constantly give thanks to God for this, that when you received the word of God that you heard from us, you accepted it, not as human words, but as what it really is, God's word, which is also at work in you believers. God's word in you, at work, if you believe. And belief means doing. So what they saw is they saw examples. Not like the Pharisees. We saw examples. They saw examples in Paul and his entourage. How they showed up among them and they didn't burden them. They did for them. They served. They did all kinds of things. And that is the word of what the kingdom looks like. The greatest of among you will be what? The servant of all. So what did Paul and his guys do? They were the servants to the Thessalonians. Did the Thessalonians deserve it? No. Pagan worshipers and all kinds of stuff. But what did they do? They did the work. And what did the Thessalonians become? Just like Paul. They received that word. And it was put into practice. Now what we did here is we went through the time of Joshua and what God really meant and how God nurtured them and brought them through this, you know, and created memories for them to know who God is, to worship him in serving the world, and to love people. We see many generations down the road how that eroded and got all fouled up and all screwed up. By the time Jesus shows up on the scene in the first century, well, 3 AD or something, and now here he is, 33 years later, he is walking around and he's telling these people who were supposed to be just like Moses that they're corrupt, that they're hypocrites, that they're wearing masks, they're not right, they've changed the law into something horrible, and everything that they learned in the desert is gone, except for the words, except for the law. And Jesus comes along and he reinterprets the law and he points out their mistakes and he says you're wrong and he says your temple system is wrong and you treat people badly and now you're not a light to the nation anymore and I'm sick of it. And if we finish reading Matthew 23, you see Jesus freaking out. You see him flipping on these people that have so misplaced their thoughts. And because their thoughts are misplaced, their worship isn't even worship. They can't serve anybody. In Matthew 25, Jesus says, if you've done it unto the least of these, you've done it unto me. And what are they doing? They're hurting people. Who are they hurting? Jesus. When Paul is converted later on the road to Damascus, what does Jesus say? Why are you persecuting me? Who was he persecuting? The church? The least? This has everything to do with the way we think. The word that's deposited in us has everything to do with how we become worshipers of God? How do we understand God? Do we even understand God? And if we will not adopt this, if we won't endeavor to do this, everything that we do is in vain. We are hypocrites. We fall down on the wrong side of God's will. It's the word liturgy, which is what we're doing, is it literally means the work of the people or the worship of the people. And what we do in churches is we do liturgy. We have the lectionary reading, and what we'll do is we'll do a ceremony, and we'll do those, and we call that work, worship toward God. But if that worship stays in the building and never leaves the building and doesn't turn into the reason that we are worshiping you is we're getting face to face with you again so we can go out there and be your representatives so that the ark goes before us. So that everything that we believe about you is what we exhibit to people. We go outside of this place to be your hands and feet in the earth. And your character, everything that was in that ark, everything that we wanted the kids to remember along the Jordan River and generations to come, everything that Jesus straightens out, everything that these Thessalonians know because of Paul and his guys and the example that they are. Working toward God. The things that we do because of him. Because now we want his pleasure. Now if we do something for somebody who doesn't even deserve it, we have fixed in our mind, he's representative of Jesus. He's the least. And if I'm doing it to him, I'm doing it to Christ. So if worship is honoring God and service to him, the way he receives it in Matthew 25 is on to him. Work out there. Worship in here. All of that gelling together to honor God is called worship. So our living liturgy, the way that we follow the ark, the way of the ark, is what reconnects us to a broken worship. What I want you to go home thinking about, we sang here. We worshiped God. We said things to him, idealistically some of them hoping, but really trying to get nose to nose with him. And what I want you to go home thinking about is how is this place, if that's what we do here, how is this place connected to that place out there?
You have been listening to Beside Stillwater's netcast. For more information about Stillwater's and its ministries, please visit besidestillwaters.net.